This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, May 16th. I'm John Wanamaker. Lawmakers at the state capitol kicked into overdrive last night, agreeing in principle to all of the outstanding issues remaining in the legislative session. Early this morning, the House passed two bills that spend more than $1 billion on public works projects across the state, and later today, lawmakers are poised to pass another round of tax cuts, a bill that legalizes medical marijuana, and a bill that increases spending for schools, health care, and broadband internet. Assuming all that passes, the session should end today. Tom Scheck has more.
The House took up the bonding bill at 2 a.m., roughly 5 hours after legislative leaders in the House and Senate cut a deal on which projects would be in the public works borrowing bill. Key among them is $126 million for the renovation of the state capitol, $279 million for the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and $113 million for roads and bridges. A companion bill also dedicates $200 million in cash for civic centers in Mankato, Rochester, and St. Cloud, and funding for the Lewis and Clark water pipeline in southwestern Minnesota. DFL Representative Alice Houseman of St. Paul acknowledged the difficulty of negotiating a bonding bill.
And so we had to accommodate House and Senate. And in the last days, some additional requests from House Minority and, of course, the governor. And doing that, every time we did it, some bills fell by the wayside.
Republicans, who have spent the last several months criticizing Democrats for their spending in the bonding bill, were more muted in their critique. In fact, the biggest complaint came from lawmakers, such as Republican Representative Anna Wills of Apple Valley, who weren't happy that their projects missed the cut.
Projects that were further down in the ranking were included, and yet the Dakota County Technical College was not included.
Even though several Republicans like Wills lost out, GOP legislative leaders won big. 8 Republican votes were needed along with every Democrat in order to get the supermajority needed to pass the bill in the House. And Republicans used that leverage to their advantage by securing full funding for the Lewis and Clark pipeline. They convinced Democrats to pay $22 million in cash for the project, promise state aid in the tax bill, and grant taxing authority to local communities to finance it in the long term. DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen said the pipeline was the linchpin to securing a successful end to the legislative session.
That was the thing that was most important to the Republicans, and probably, you know, and a very important thing for the state too. So figuring out an alternative mechanism to doing that is what got us the place where we could get an agreement to kind of move these things forward.
Republicans also secured a few other commitments. Key among them was an agreement that Democrats drop their push to require manufacturers to disclose the presence of toxic chemicals in children's products, a measure called the Toxic Free Kids Act. Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hahn said Democrats agreed to drop several provisions to ensure an orderly end to the session.
In exchange for our votes to do that, we asked for some of the bills that probably aren't going anywhere anyway to just be set aside so nobody has to worry about them.
Governor Dayton made a last-minute push to include the Toxic Free Kids Act in a supplemental budget bill, but legislators eventually rejected it. The Budget Committee did agree to accept several of Dayton's other requests before wrapping up their work earlier this morning. DFL Senator Dick Cohen of St. Paul said the budget bill spends roughly $260 million on early childhood and K-12 education, funding for home and community-based health workers, and funding for rural broadband. Cohen says the budget bill will also provide debt service for the Bell Museum project. That was a key priority for the House Capital Investment Chair, but it was cut from the bonding bill in order to accept a greater number of Republican projects. Cohen said it would have been easier if Republicans would have just agreed to a larger bonding bill instead of holding to a pledge that the bonding bill be no larger than $846 million and forcing public works spending in tax and budget bills.
Going through all these somersaults to get around what would be a very fiscally responsible number, clearly within Minnesota's debt capacity. To avoid right-wing political talking points.
House and Senate leaders appear confident that they'll finish their work today, a couple days short of Monday's constitutional deadline. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
And as Tom mentioned, lawmakers are expected to vote today on medical marijuana legislation, a compromise that's getting mixed reviews from some patients and parents who would be eligible to use the drug. Lawmakers announced a deal yesterday that would allow access by qualified patients to cannabis in pill or liquid form. Smoking would be prohibited, as well as the vaporizing of dried leaves. During a conference committee hearing, Cassie Tron of St. Paul shared her concerns about the restriction. Tron told lawmakers she's been illegally vaporizing cannabis in plant form as a successful treatment for Crohn's disease.
I'm completely unsure whether or not using solely oils will keep me in remission like whole plant does. So my choices now are to use a form of cannabis that may or may not work, or to remain a criminal to access the type of cannabis that I know works for me.
Others are praising the compromise. Angie Weaver of Hibbing said legal access to medical cannabis will help treat her daughter's seizures without needing to move to another state. The House and Senate will vote today. The bonding bill also includes more than $56 million for an overhaul of the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. Matt Sepik has that.
About 400 people deemed mentally ill and dangerous live at the hospital. State officials say its narrow stairs and blind corners make the facility unsafe for staff and residents. In January, a patient was killed, allegedly by another patient. And last year, state investigators say a resident banged his head against a concrete wall for 3 hours before staff stopped him. DFLer Clark Johnson represents the hospital's district in the Minnesota House and says the building will be remodeled and expanded.
Basically, what the money is going to be used for is to make a more modern facility to improve the care and to improve safety for both patients and the people who work there.
The bill also includes more than $7 million to renovate the Minnesota Sex Offender Program facility that's also on the St. Peter campus. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A wide-ranging health policy bill that bans indoor tanning use by children and puts greater restrictions on the use of e-cigarettes is on its way to Governor Dayton. The bill would ban the use of e-cigarettes in government buildings, in schools, and on the campuses of the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. The measure would not ban e-cigarettes in bars and restaurants. DFL Representative Lori Halverson of Eagan says it's a good first step, but she would have preferred a wider ban.
These are not safe devices. They contain known carcinogens. If you are near somebody who is smoking an electronic cigarette, you will be exposed to known carcinogens, including formaldehyde.
The bill would also allow cities and counties to ban the use of e-cigarettes. Critics say the science isn't there to prove vapors emitted from e-cigarettes cause harm. Governor Dayton says he supports the bill. And lawmakers are poised to ban instant play lottery games and tickets sold at gas pumps and ATMs. A joint House-Senate conference committee has approved the ban. It would give the Minnesota Lottery until the end of October to phase out the games. Lawmakers have criticized Minnesota Lottery officials for expanding access to new games without getting legislative approval. But the lottery's executive director, Ed Van Petten, said the move could cost the state millions in lost revenue and lawsuits from contractors. He also said he would prefer to see Governor Dayton veto the bill.
I'd like to continue our projects, but if the legislature doesn't want more money, you know, I can't make them take money.
A spokesman for Dayton says he hasn't yet formed a position on the bill. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Federal authorities say they have uncovered a plot to supply firearms to gang members. According to federal indictments released yesterday, two women bought several guns for men who are prohibited from having them. Authorities say one of the guns was used in a gang-related shooting earlier this year. Brant Williams reports.
The court documents show the investigation started from a traffic stop in February. Police officers found three guns in a car with three of the five people charged in the case. 20-year-old Kaniko Bland, 32-year-old Angela Carter, and 21-year-old DeAndre Hill. Carter was driving the car. The two men weren't supposed to have guns because of their criminal records. Scott Sweeto is a special agent in charge of the St. Paul branch of the ATF. He says a trace report found that one of the guns in the car had a very short time to crime.
In layman's terms, that means that we were able to show that the firearm had been purchased literally just days before by somebody and had already been recovered by the police.
In fact, according to the documents, all three of the guns had been allegedly purchased within the last month, two by Carter and one by 29-year-old Jacqueline Burns, the other woman indicted in the conspiracy. Suito says guns that go from purchase to crime so quickly often indicate an illegal connection between the purchaser and the person police find with the gun.
Typically, when somebody buys a firearm, they're going to keep it. They may keep it in their car, they may keep it in their house or business, but when you see a female purchasing a firearm and then it turns up in the hands of a number of suspected gangbangers, that's something that we're very interested in running to ground.
The court documents allege DeAndre Hill is a self-professed member of a gang called BTG, a subset of the Tre Tre Crips. Hill allegedly developed a romantic relationship with Jacqueline Burns while she worked as a corrections officer in the Hennepin County Jail, and he was locked up there. Angela Carter worked as a prep cook at South High School and was allegedly romantically involved with Kaniko Bland, who police believe is a member of BTG. Investigators say the fifth person charged in the conspiracy, 21-year-old Raheem Abdul Lee Watkins, calls himself a member of a movement, not a gang.
It's not an unusual scheme. It's unusual that we were able to pull together enough evidence to prosecute it.
U.S. Attorney Andy Luger says the men charged in this case are all legally prohibited from having guns and face up to 15 years in prison if convicted. And he says the women also face long prison sentences if convicted for making false statements about their firearms purchases. Luger says the women engaged in so-called straw purchases, where they bought guns for people they knew weren't legally allowed to have them.
So we're being very aggressive in straw purchasing cases and in similar cases where we can tie illegal weapons to gang members in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, but elsewhere in throughout the state, quite frankly.
Luger says one of the guns allegedly purchased by Burns in January was recovered at the scene of a shooting at a downtown Minneapolis strip club less than a month later. Earlier this week, one of Angela Carter's daughters, who is 9, was seriously injured by flying glass after a man tied to DeAndre Hill fired a gun at her car. However, Luger says that incident is not tied to this conspiracy. Luger says the investigation into the conspiracy continues.
That's reporter Brad Williams, and to see the indictment in this case, go to nprnews.org. DFL Congressman Tim Walz says federal regulators should consider the unique needs of some communities as they develop new safety standards for moving oil freight. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Walz made the comments during a meeting with local, state, and federal officials in Rochester. No oil freight traffic moves through Rochester, but Walz says the city is a central source for hazmat response in southeastern Minnesota. He also says the proximity of tracks to the Mayo Clinic makes rail safety a high priority.
The challenges in Rochester are an immobile population at the Mayo Clinic that could not be moved. So if you had an incident, it would look unlike almost any place else in the country in terms of how do you move thousands of hospital patients where the nearest level one trauma center is 80 miles away.
Last year, U.S. railroads hauled about 415,000 carloads of crude oil, compared to fewer than 10,000 cars in 2008. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
And believe it or not, traffic jams are easing in the Twin Cities, according to a report from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. A new study shows that congestion dipped 1.5% from 2012 to 2013. The annual study looks at speed patterns each October. When traffic falls to 45 miles an hour or below, a highway is considered congested. University of Minnesota traffic researcher John Huertas says MnDOT has been ahead of the curve in implementing traffic-reducing technologies.
I think the technology and the work that MnDOT is putting with the MinPass lanes, the intelligent lane control signs, and variable speed limits, all of these are cutting-edge systems that are helping fight congestion.
Huertas says MnDOT has reduced bottlenecks along 35W in South Minneapolis, as well as 694 and 35 East. He says those projects have eased thousands of hours of congestion. But the best way to fight congestion, Huertas says, is by increasing public transit use. University of Minnesota football coach Jerry Kill and his wife are setting up a fund to pay for training on how to respond to epileptic seizures. Alex Friedrich reports.
The Kills have donated $100,000 to the fund and hope to raise at least another $400,000 by August. Much of the money would go to schools to teach students and staff about what to do when someone has a seizure. Jerry Kill has had several well-publicized seizures. His wife Rebecca helped save his life during one episode. but she says she wasn't in a position to do that until she became educated about responding.
The first time, you know, I ever saw him have one, of course, I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't very calm, screaming, you know, don't know what to do.
In addition to funding training, the money would also support a camp for young people with epilepsy. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, St. Paul has a new full-service grocery store as Lund's Food Holding opened its 24th Twin Cities location. The event sparked new hopes for boosters of the state's second-largest downtown. Tim Nelson was there and has a look at the prospects.
Okay, it's just groceries. Cored pineapple, sliced turkey, a rack of bread, the usual. But Bianca Pettis admits she's excited that she won't have to take the bus to get them. She's a musician and artist that lives in St. Paul's Lower Landing neighborhood.
You know what? I'm a biker and I don't have a car, so I take the bus. And I usually take a bus to Whole Foods or I'll take a bus over to Trader Joe's from downtown St. Paul. And so this is really going to make a difference. I walked here today. You know, I'm going to get my little grocery bag, except for a cup of coffee.
She was one of hundreds of people packed in among the apples and bananas at Robert and 10th Streets today as the new Lund store opened its doors and raised the prospect of a downtown revival. It isn't the first time St. Paul has gotten its hopes up. The city is dotted with decades of disappointments, many of them publicly subsidized, like Gaultier Plaza, the World Trade Center, the Amhoy's Tower, and the vacant Macy's store. The difference, says Mayor Chris Coleman, is that the city considers development like the grocery store an effect rather than a cause.
When the projects that were built, you know, in the 70s and the 80s were being built, it was trying to arrest a pattern of people leaving cities and saying, what do we need to do to get them to come back? And now what we're seeing is people, that migration or, you know, immigration is really, it's already happening. You know, people want to be downtown. People want to be, you know, whether you're a young person that's just starting off their career, or an empty nester that wants to be more centrally located to activities.
Population figures from the State Demographic Center confirm the trend. The number of residents in St. Paul's downtown core has risen from about 4,400 in 1990 to more than 7,000 at the time of the last census. Former St. Paul Planning and Economic Development Director Cecile Bedore, who helped seal the Lund's deal, says employment has also been quietly picking up.
I think that the state's office workers obviously are huge. All five of our downtown hospitals have done significant expansion. We have Cray that came in, Microsoft. I know there's two other deals that the city's working on right now to bring in more folks to downtown.
Lund Food Holding CEO Trace Lund says the opening is also a testament to how the grocery business has changed to crack the code of downtown retail.
There's no question the urban shopper shops differently. More frequently during the week, we see this at our Hennepin and our Central locations. The average shopping occurrence in a grocery store across the country is 2.7 times a week. We're probably closer to 4.5 in our urban locations. They're coming in for meals as they need them.
Lund says a different product mix with the wide selection but less depth is part of it. Prepared foods and an orientation toward foot traffic are also part of the formula. Holly Folker says she hopes it will be part of the glue that makes downtown a regular neighborhood. She's a grant administrator for the state and commutes in the Skyway from her downtown condo on 9th Street.
You know, just having the convenience of, you know, I need sugar, I need eggs, you know, having the grocery store next door is going to be pretty big, because the time that you spend getting on the bus and going to do your daily activities, it adds up.
The store is also part of something of a building boom in downtown St. Paul. A new baseball stadium is under construction in Lower Town. The restored Union Depot opened last year. The Ordway and Park Square Theater are expanding, and new residences are going up on the west side, in the old downtown post office tower, and in the Pioneer Endicott buildings on Robert Street. And all of that will be a short walk from the Green Line light rail service set to open June 14th. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Happy shopping, everyone. And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, May 16th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.